going to say it's my own idea. I haven't really got any solid evidence for it. But I have the impression that this method of controlling light industry through contracts arose from the way in which they took over the old capitalists in the coastal cities. There was a development, particularly of textile industry, very little of heavy industry or engineering or that sort, but there was a certain amount of light industry, and there was quite a big development of cotton textiles and silk in the treaty ports. And the number of capitalists, of course, skipped off to Hong Kong or to Taiwan, but those were left, the patriotic national bourgeoisie, were encouraged to go and produce. And they were linked into the economy by a system of contracts. They were sold cotton, and these goods were bought from them. And they were allowed a profit margin calculated to cover their cost of production and their wage bill, and a very small profit margin. And so the planning authorities bought from the piece of goods and supplied them with materials. And then they could dispose of the piece of goods which they bought through the shops and be sold to the public. Well, this method is used quite generally throughout the whole economy. That is a system of purchasing on contract from producers in turn enter into contracts with each other for the supplies of the intermediate goods which they don't buy. And the organ of the Ministry of Internal Trade operates as a wholesale agent. Now, the producers have all been sucked into the through the state private system, so now everybody's in the socialist economy. I don't get any private production at all except a very small amount of handicrafts in the communes where they can sell products at the trade fairs. But practically speaking, all production now, big and small, is in the socialist system. But it operates through this method of state wholesaling, which controls the production and the retail outlets. Now, how does this work? The very simple example is the way in which the cities are supplied with vegetables and fruit. The authority of the city enter into contracts with a number of surrounding communes, which agree in the law what supplies will come in and set the prices. And these contracts are broken down into individual arrangements between particular teams in the commune, which is in charge of a vegetable outfit, and a shop or a street corner store, which is selling the vegetables in the city. So it's, so to say, a wholesale notion, but the actual retailing is brought fresh from the fields to the shop every morning. The team is responsible for bringing the stuff in. In the early days, it was mostly done by carts, some carts with donkeys, and some carts without donkeys, and men pulling them. Now they're gradually getting more and more trucks, and so the kind of thing that way. But the contract is made directly between the team and the shop. So many cabbages, so many tomatoes, and so on. break even and become the teams which are producing have a steady income, but the public gets the benefit of the suppliers. It's the same. The summer flush thing, price is extremely low. In fact, one time you used to go along and they dumped tomatoes into your basket. It wasn't worthwhile to wait. The price was so low. Well, this is a very convenient way of overcoming the problem of seasonal supplies. They have higher prices in the spring. That is a sufficient difference in incomes to be able to have a little bit of a luxury market, so that some people will buy at a higher price in the spring and other people will wait and just make do with cabbages. By this means, they could arrange to have a profitable trade, in the sense that the city authorities make a small profit, break even, make a small profit. The farmers get a fair income all year round, and the public gets the benefit of the supply and demand price. This is solution of the problem, which is an absolute pest in all capitalist countries. The problem of the farmer who hanged himself in the expectation of plenty. And the waste, of course, we have it, we have it in England, stuff rotting on the trees because it's not worth paying the price for having it. When the habits of the good. Vegetable contracts are sought after because you can get four or five crops from your little bit of ground so that you're getting money income all year round. Whereas the people who are growing grain don't get such a big money income. But the vegetable people, of course, are working for them, but they don't have any specs. Vegetable contracts are nice to hear because doing it is for the contracts. And so the city authorities can place their contracts where they like. As output, as productivity expands, they get a tendency for an oversupply, and then the teams will have to reduce the acreage and turn over more land to something else. After the Cultural Revolution, there was a great deal of improvement in everything. One of the things that was improved was making little greenhouses. A very simple thing, you know, two bags of a piece of cellophane. By this means, you can bring on vegetables early, old tomatoes, and spread out the season. Now, one chap I spoke to, a vegetable commune near. He said, we used to think, what we grow, they've got to eat. And now we realize that it's important to meet demand as well as we can, and so we've spread out our season by this device, getting some ripening earlier, some ripening later. And so that this problem of practically throwing away tomatoes during the summer, I suppose, is reduced now because we've succeeded in getting supply to spread out. This is Shao-Chi is accused of wanting to use the price maker and instruct the enterprises to maximize profits. Maximizing profits in this context certainly calls me making profits in the sense of a return on capital. It means the excess of receipts over costs, so it's a flow force. But I was given some examples. Children's services and services, regulated grown-up services. But the profit margin on the little stock is smaller than on the grown-up stock. So if we pursued the profit directive, as Liu Shaoqi wanted us to, we'd be making grown-up stocks and not enough children's services. Well, now we make it our business to find out what people are demanding and to make. When they get the orders, from the shop through the contract to the enterprise, and by this means they've overcome. Now this very problem of children's sizes and grown-up sizes was a tremendous headache in the Soviet Union. One of the cases they quote of a successful reform, that when they allowed the enterprise to charge prices according to demand, they had a big change in their assortment plan and a big increase in the number of children's sizes that they were producing, because that was what the families wanted to buy. But and the Chinese schemes, it happens automatically. And it seems to me that this method of operating through contracts has taken them, as I say, right past the corner in which the Soviet system has got jammed up. One of the necessary conditions for this system to work is that the enterprise is not directly interested in the commercial aspect of production. Now, I think the Yugoslavia involved. The Yugoslavia gave the workers the equity in the business, and then they were in charge of selling, and they therefore became interested in making profits from the market. But similarly, Schick scheme, which was trying to introduce a bit of market control, giving a commercial interest to the enterprise. I believe in Hungary, I haven't been in Hungary yet, and I might have been there for a minute, there are a tremendous lot of little businesses under guise of being cooperatives, because the agricultural sector is cooperative, and then you can have little businesses of leaning and making up. And then they become businesses, they become little capital. Economic power then goes back to the producers, and not to the consumer. But in the Chinese system, the enterprise that has absolutely no commercial interest in what it sells, the output is given to the contract. Design, delivery dates, quality, everything is fully specified in the contract. And all they've got to do is to produce what's in the contract, as efficiently as possible, and keep a good morale for their workers. The suppliers coming to them, the materials they're to make is in the plan. If they don't succeed in getting what they need, there's always an element of making do. The Chinese say you must always make a plan which leaves some leeway. Now, for instance, enterprise making shoes, this is not a commodity which comes under the national plan, you come under the province of city plan. So they've been allocated a certain amount of labor, but not enough to keep their own labor force occupied. scrounge around and see if they can't find a bit more, or find if they can use some substances, or rearrange the work in such a way that they can work through. So there's always this element of initiative and local control at the margin, say, but the broad life of the plan will allocate to them the materials they need to carry out their output, their wage bill is given to them, and the prices at which goods change hands are not a matter of interest. Prices for the that way to cover the cost include the percentage profit which exactly what the producer wants to be asked for, so that they haven't any of the trouble of selling, which of course in the capitalist system is the big preoccupation of any sort of business. They're only told to make the stuff, the problem is to sell it. So this is cut out by the Chinese movement. Now, on top of the relation from the consumer through the shops, through the food chains, the enterprises make it their business to find out consumers' tastes and get their criticism. This, I think, again, is a feature which has been very much increased under the influence of the Cultural Revolution, the anti-Liu Xiaoqing campaign. An enterprise, say, producing textiles, will send some workers and carters to a department store, and they'll serve at the counter where they're going to be sold, and incite the customers to give their remarks, say what they like and what they don't like. And they send people into the country. The shops in the villages are still nominally under the supply and marketing organization, which was set up when there were still private persons. The first move to get agriculture integrated into the economy was the supply and marketing organization, which were taking goods to the country and taking supplies from it. Now, of course, the communes are all integrated into the national plan through their project contracts. And the shops are still nominally a supply and marketing organization, but in fact they are integrated into this wholesaling system. So the enterprises will send someone to the country or to a cantonment, which is probably going on in there, and find out what they want. The enterprises are instructed to produce the kind of goods which will be sold in the country. Particularly heavy type of bicycle that can be ridden on dirt roads, and a more elegant kind of bicycle that can be ridden in the city. A great part of Chairman Mao's policy is based on avoiding the mistakes that were made in the Soviet Union. And this was a very notorious mistake in the Soviet Union. Perhaps they couldn't be blamed because of the situation they were in. But the scissors crisis, which arose from the fact that there was nothing for the peasants to spend money on, and therefore they had no motive to earn money, and therefore they had no motive to sell their crops. And this is the impasse that had been reached before the collectivization. And the collectivization was such a very brutal way of solving the problem that I think the Soviet agriculture doesn't to this day really recover from. But the Chinese system is for all the main crops, grain, vegetable oil, cotton, tobacco, and so on, all the main crops, each commune has an annual agreement for quota sales. The commune is responsible for discussing the production of the individual seeds. Everything is done on the system from the bottom up and from the top down. And the commune enters into conversation with the county authorities, and it's the business of the commune through the brigades and the teams to discuss the principle, a grain producing onion is supposed to keep enough to feed those families, each team is supposed to keep enough to feed those families round the year, and then they enter into an agreement for selling a quota in excess of it. The quotas are all taken at fixed prices. There is also a land tax, but that's becoming less and less important because it's fixed on the national output in 51, and as productivity has increased, the proportion of the surplus where it's least painful to part with it. Because a commune in a rich area has a higher output per head and therefore more available to sell after they've fed them. So the surplus is skimmed off in this way. But the necessary corollary of that is to make the peasants pleased to have money. Willing to sell. Having a high quota imposed on you is not a terrible burden of others. You're pleased to be able to provide a high quota and get less money in. The money income will then be distributed to households in accumulation funds set by the commune. In each brigade, or they have an accumulation fund of about, say, 60% of gross income is normal. Distributed. And this can be spent by the households on whatever they like. Buy a certain amount from each other, and sauces and wine, and so on through the shop, and they buy textiles, furniture, and so on. They also save, and one very interesting way of catching purchasing power back from the family is that the communal, or generally I think it's at the brigade level, the brigade will have a building team. Now, the builders in the northwest, where they have these caves, now they build imitation caves in stone. They're the same, they're accustomed to living in these sort of houses. Now they build the same thing, same shape as a cave, they build it in stone. Other places they build with bricks, and many communes have their own brick and tile works on the block. And now you can put your name for a house. Say you're living in a mud house, now you have a bucket house, and you're living in an earth cave, you have a stone cave. Or the family has got too big and you need some more room. So you put your name down, and when you've saved up enough, you can pay for the house. You'll turn to the house. In some cases, you can get a loan, but I think only for 2 years you can get the house built ahead. If you have the two, the workforce two in the family, they're going to be earning workforce and getting money, and so you can take a loan for a part of the cost of the house. But mostly you're expected to save up and get some cash in hand. But the banking system within the commons, the savings bank, and then the building team is paid workers. There's no direct commercial relationship between the person buying a house and the building. This again is worked through the common organization. And this is a very important point in all the money relations within the common system. For instance, if you're in a vegetable team or a cotton growing team, tobacco growing team, your whole income will be in money. I mean, you may get just a bit of the vegetables on the side, but broadly speaking, your whole taking the amount of money because you're producing a good to be sold. Whereas the ordinary runner, eating the grain grain and keeping some food himself to sell at the farm. Well, now, a team like that, which is growing a cash crop, what we should call a cash crop, getting their whole income in terms of money, they've got to buy grain. Now, they can't buy grain from next door, but there's a grain grain. They've got to get it from the market. Again, actually, it's a school from next door physically, but nationally, it's got to be bought by a person as well. And this seems to me to be a device for preventing corruption from creeping into the system. So you never have any direct monetary relations within the economy. Apart from this very minor one of selling something through the cooperative shop or keeping local fair, they very much encourage most brigades have a breeding station where they have people who understand about pigs and are experts in breeding pigs, and then they give out pigs to the households. And the household will feed their pig with household scraps or with the produce from their private plot or by going out in the country and cutting green leaves in the river or the farmer can be. The manure from the pig can then be sold to the brigade with its milk from the selling the manure. And when your pig is ready to be killed, you can either have a grand memory put on the spot, or you can sell it to the shop, the shop, and get meat coupons. So then you can spread out your eating of your pig, over the, have it all at once. Or you can sell it at the local fair. Local fairs were a question in the during the Cultural Revolution between the ultra-left and the capitalist raiders, because one of the things that Liu Shaoqi was accused of was wanting to build up the local fairs, wanted to give the households a direct economic interest in selling their handicrafts and selling their products. Then the ultra-left wanted to abolish them altogether. Until the pro goes on. When I was there, it was 2 years ago, in some places they've been abolished completely. Some of the most advanced communes are giving them up. But in other places they were permitted or even encouraged. But the very strict rule that you're not allowed to buy something to sell it again. Again, there's no commercial element. You're directly selling something to the chapters and to the consumer. No goods which come into the national plan, as grain, vegetable oil, etc., are allowed to be handled. Only these odds and ends of handicraft products, particularly eggs, some vegetables outside of the country. So the teams also use them. You go to a local fair, you see a truck come in which a team is sending. So this is some surplus ever above what they're selling on their regular contract. They've got a bit extra, so they send it to the fair and get money for it. Prices are under the influence of supply and demand, subject to a ceiling. And the fairs are regulated by the county authorities. They keep an eye on them to see that the spontaneous growth of capitalism will be kept in check. There's always this Chinese way of not pushing things on a theoretical point beyond what's reasonable. On the other hand, not allowing the commercial element to undermine the general development. Well, it's a little bit of information I'm able to give you, but I would rather like to discuss this general question of what you ought to do about the problem of socialist affluence in the Western Now, I've often discussed this with my Polish friends, and they could never see it. They just couldn't understand how this Chinese system could work. And they say, well, it may be all right for the Chinese, but I'm sure European people can never work on this system. And they stress the importance of giving incentives to the enterprises. The enterprises can then give the bonuses to their people, or the leader of the enterprise gets the bonus. Then they try and fix up a system by which the enterprises in the consumer goods sphere will produce what the customers want to buy. And I don't think any of them have succeeded in getting such a system going. And I think it's very, very hard to do so. Because as long as the initiative lies with the producer, and the economic power is in the hands of the producer, how are you ever going to get a sensitive response to the demands of the consumer? Either you make a buyer's market by restricting incomes and make it difficult for the enterprises to sell. Well, that's a very wasteful way. As long as you leave the enterprises free to dump onto the market what they produce, and as long as the consumers have got money to spend, they'll buy what's there. I believe that this has become quite a serious problem in the Soviet Union, that people's tastes are advanced ahead of what's being produced, and there's a frightful problem of cash being saved. People didn't need things. People just weren't then want to buy the money, which they produce is quite often. And there's a black market in foreign goods. I mean, it's still true. Young men go in a pair of old jeans, a green spitz will come up to do an article. How are you to get over this problem of throwing the power to the consumer, away from the producer? And the Chinese system, you see, the enterprise has got no commercial interest and is inculcated with this spirit to serve the people, and therefore gets satisfaction from producing the goods that consumers want. They might just as well, because they haven't got any problem about finding outlets and looking at their things given to them through the system. Well, another thing that the Polish people say, oh well, I'm quoting Poland simply because I haven't had any friends in Poland. But Polish people say, well, it's all right, but the Chinese are at a very simple standard of life and a very uniform distribution of income. They have very uniform taste, so this system can work. But I don't see why it shouldn't work at any level. I mean, they're beginning now to, particularly in Shanghai, they're beginning to introduce quite sophisticated consumer goods. They're gradually spreading. Why shouldn't this method work? Of course, the question of innovations, that again is looked after by this spirit of serve the people, because an enterprise will carry out experiments, for instance, in textiles, they're carrying out experiments now with the synthetic fibers, and then they put on the market, they have a display sale in the big department store in Shanghai. This is the usual feature, is a display sale of some new commodity. People from the enterprise are serving in the shop and connecting opinions with the people and encouraging to give their views. So new commodities put on the market, and when the consumers have a power of veto, is all actually a consumer sovereignty can ever be in deciding not to buy something they don't like, otherwise, what is does consumer sovereignty consist of? As long as the initiative lies with the producer. Now, in the capitalist world, we certainly haven't got anything like consumer sovereignty. In the Soviets, they're trying, the people's democracies, they're trying to way towards a system which would allow the senior states to play upon the sort of conflict, but they don't seem to be able to manage it, except by going down the slippery slope of giving the enterprise a fully commercial interest in their sale. So this seems to me to be the problem. People, those who travel in that part of the world and thought about it from a theoretical point of view, how you manage to get over the problem of socialist efforts.
Taken in the central plan, the question whether you're going to have audience. Because as we know, you bring a complete change to the habits of life. You have all China. We don't doesn't have any private cars at all, and I have been in the room. They have good public transport, not a big amount of introduced tax. And people with offices they're not going to indulge in private perhaps in some distant future that will go down the slippery slope, which is certainly going down now, but as far as I can see, they're not.
No, they're not going to. I was wondering on what basis those decisions are made.
Well, that is a decision which must be made at the centre. It's an extremely crucial decision. So once the Soviets adopted the slogan of overtaking the United States, to imitate as opposed to imitating
but from the way you laid it out, John, it appears that you're actually pinpointing the answer yourself to the extent that you say that it's the ideology of serving the people that is decisive for the Chinese case.
Yes,
it's not simply the organizational
it's a mixture.
Form.
I mean, the organization and the spirit which is carried out play together. Now, whether you could make such an organization work in a country which has already got corrupted and accustomed to reigning is, I think, a very big problem. I think they've got to start from where they are. With the Stalinist system of directives and commands, the most loyal and devoted man has got to bend the rules. Because the rules simply don't fit. They're not consistent. They don't make sense. So everybody gets into the custom of wrangling to do a good deed, as well as wrangling to pursue their self-interest. And when that is broken down, socialist narrative, it's very, very hard to explain. It's a big problem. Yeah?
It seems likely to me that this kind of a problem of case running ahead of production.
Wow.
They seem to have a tremendous that would just come to the West. And the government itself, you know, it's a small thing in itself, but they enroll in the policies there, such as they have things called dollar shops, you know, which they have on the main streets of Bucharest, and they offer goods like American cigarettes and American products to American tourists only. You have to have an American And, of course, I talked to a very wide segment of people, I suppose, but that sort of thing seems very important. I'm just that one example, for example, the dollar shops, you know, and giving the people a tremendous feeling, you know, that American cigarettes in themselves, you know, just because they're American cigarettes, you know, will work twice or three times what the domestic cigarettes will work, you know, regardless of the quality of it. And, I mean, I think that general sort of phenomenon is building up.
I don't know about cigarettes, but in textiles, Western design and whatever it is, Western control by Western. Like jeans, because it's a matter of fashion, not quality. So it's a combination. First of all, I absolutely agree that in the first stage of socialism, the iron curtain is absolutely invalid. And the Chinese have sort of natural iron curtain. When you've reached the stage that you have got industries, why can't they produce this and this and this? The mixture. The mixture of taste and passion and the glamour of the West, and the fact that their own stuff is not good quality. Well, the Chinese are continually improving their
are things like the Great Cultural Revolution to some degree signs that this system does have a tendency to deteriorate every once in a while, and it has to be, the socialist morality has to be brought back up to par by mass campaigns?
Yeah.
Is there any smaller corrective than the masses, than those mass movements? I mean, are firms subjected to some kind of criticism and so forth from outside of themselves?
Yes, I mean, this business of criticism is going on all the time. Yeah, I mean, it must be a continual process to keep up this extraordinary high level of consciousness. There's a very nice book I'd recommend to everybody by Jack Chen called A Year in Upper Felicity, where he went with some old carters. He's an overseas Chinese, and he was working as a journalist in China. And he went with some old cargoes when they went down to the country. And he lived around 1 year in this village. And he gives you an account of daily life of the people and all of the episodes as well. And one thing happened, he was sitting with a woman with her baby, and they'd just been garnering the corn, you see, on a carpet.